Chapter 25. The Paragon. There are three things in life that can make even the worst problems seem just that tiniest bit better. The first is a cup of tea, loose leaf Assam with a hint of lapsang and poured before it gets too dark, and then with a dash of milk and the smallest hint of sugar. Calming, soothing, and almost without peer. The second, naturally, is a hot soaking bath. The third is Puccini. In the bath, with a hot cup of tea and Puccini. Heaven. It was called the Paragon, and was the most perfect 1920s tea room, nestled in the safe and unobserved background fabric of P.G. Woodhouse's Summer Lightning. To your left and right, upon entering through the carved wooden doors, were glass display cases containing the most sumptuous homemade cakes and pastries. Beyond these were the tea rooms proper, with booths and tables constructed of a dark wood that perfectly matched the panelled interior. This was itself decorated with plaster reliefs of Greek characters disporting themselves in matters of equestrian and athletic prowess. To the rear were two additional and private tea rooms, the one of light-coloured wood and the other in delicate carvings of a most agreeable nature. Needless to say, it was inhabited by the most populous characters in Woodhouse's novels. That is to say, it was full of voluble and opinionated aunts. There were two jurisfiction agents sitting at the table we usually reserved for our 3:30 tea and cakes. The first was tall and dressed in jet black, high-collared robes buttoned tightly up to his throat. He had a pale complexion, prominent cheekbones, and a small and very precise goatee. He sat with his arms crossed and was staring at all the other customers in the tea rooms with an air of haughty superiority, eyebrows raised imperiously. This was truly a tyrant among tyrants, a ruthless leader who had murdered billions in his never-ending and inadequately explained quest for the unquestioned obedience of every living entity in the known galaxy. The other, of course, was a 6-foot-tall hedgehog, dressed in a multitude of petticoats, an apron and bonnet, and carrying a wicker basket of washing. There was no more celebrated partnership in jurisfiction, either then or now. It was Mrs. Tiggywinkle and Emperor Jacques. The hedgehog from Beatrix Potter, and the Emperor from the Jacques series of bad science fiction novels. "Good afternoon, Thursday," intoned the Emperor when he saw me, a flicker of a smile attempting to crack through his imperialistic bearing. "Hi, Emperor. How's the galactic domination business these days?" "Hard work," he replied, rolling his eyes heavenward. "Honestly, I invade peaceful civilizations on a whim, destroy their cities, and generally cause a great deal of unhappy mayhem. And then they turn against me, for absolutely no reason at all." "How senselessly irrational of them," I remarked, winking at Mrs. Tiggywinkle. "Quite," continued Jacques, looking aggrieved and not getting the sarcasm. "It's not as though I put them all to the sword, anyway. I magnanimously decided to spare several hundred thousand as slaves to build an 800-foot-high statue of myself, striding triumphantly over the broken bodies of the vanquished."
"That's probably the reason they don't like you," I murmured.
"Oh," he asked in genuine concern, "do you think the statue will be too small?"
"No, it's the striding triumphantly over the broken bodies of the vanquished bit. People generally don't like having their noses rubbed in their ill fortune by the person who caused it."
Emperor Jacques snorted. "That's the problem with inferiors," he said at last. "No sense of humour."
And he lapsed into a sullen silence, took an old school exercise book from within his robes, licked a pencil stub, and started to write. I sat down next to him.
"What's that?"
"My speech. The Thargoids graciously accepted me as God Emperor of their star system, and I thought it might be nice to say a few words, sort of thank them, really, for their kindness, but underscore the humility with veiled threats of mass extermination if they step out of line.
How does it begin?
Jacques read from his notes. Dear worthless peons, I pity your irrelevance. What do you think?
Well, it's definitely to the point, I admitted. How are things on the Holmes case?
We've been trying to get into the series all morning, said Jacques, laying his modest acceptance speech aside for a moment and taking a spoonful of the pie that had been placed in front of him. But to no avail. I heard you got suspended. What was that about?
I told him about the piano and Emma, and he whistled low.
Tricky. But I shouldn't sweat it. I saw Bradshaw writing up the duty rosters for next week, and you're still on them. One moment.
He waved a carefully manicured hand at the waitress and said,
Sugar on the table, my girl, or I'll have you and your family and all your descendants put to death.
The waitress bobbed politely, ignored his manner entirely, and said, If you killed me, Your Imperial Mightiness, I wouldn't have any descendants, now would I?
Yes, well, obviously, I meant the ones yet living, girl.
Oh, she said, just so we're clear on the matter. And with a cute bob, she was gone.
I keep on having trouble with that waitress, muttered Jacques, after she had departed. Do you think she was mocking me?
Oh, no, said Mrs. Tiggywinkle, hiding a smile. I think she was terrified of you.
Has anyone thought of redirecting the Sherlock Holmes throughput feeds from the Outland? I asked. With a well-positioned textual sieve, we could bounce the series to a story code engine at TGC and rewrite the ending with Holmes and Watson from the 7% solution. It will hold things together long enough to give us time to effect a permanent answer.
But where exactly to put the sieve? Inquired Jacques, not unreasonably.
What exactly is a textual sieve? Asked Mrs. Tiggywinkle.
It's never fully explained, I replied. The waitress returned with the sugar.
Thank you, said Jacques kindly. I have decided to spare your family.
Your Highness is overly generous, replied the waitress, humouring him. Perhaps you could just torture one of us. My younger brother, for instance?
No, my mind is made up. You're to be spared. Now, be gone, or I will... Oh, no. You don't trick me that way. Be gone, or I will never torture your family.
The waitress bobbed again, thanked him, and was gone.
Perky, that one, isn't she? Said Jacques, staring after her. Do you think I should make her my wife?
You're considering getting married? Asked Mrs. Tiggywinkle, almost scorching a collar in her surprise.
I think it's high time that I did, he said. Slaughtering peaceful civilizations on a whim is a lot more fun when you've got someone to do it with.
Does your mother know about this? I asked, fully aware of the power that the Dowager Empress Tsarkina IV wielded in his books.
Emperor Jacques might have been the embodiment of terror across innumerable star systems, but he lived with his mum. And if the rumours were correct, she still insisted on bathing him.
Well, she doesn't know yet, he replied defensively, but I'm big enough to make my own decisions, you know.
Mrs. Tiggywinkle and I exchanged knowing looks. Nothing happened in the Imperial Palace without the Empress's agreement. Jacques chewed for a moment, winced, and then swallowed with a look of utter disgust on his face. He turned to Mrs. Tiggywinkle.
I think you've got my pie.
Have I? She replied offhandedly. Now you come to mention it, I thought these slugs tasted sort of funny.
They swapped pies and continued eating.
"'Miss next?'
I looked up. A confident, middle-aged woman was standing next to the table. She had starburst wrinkles around the eyes and greying brown hair,
a chickenpox scar above her left brow and asymmetric dimples. She was a well-realized character, but I didn't recognize her. At least, not at first. "Can I help you?" I asked. "I'm looking for the jurisfiction agent named Thursday Next."
"That's me."
Our visitor seemed relieved at this and allowed herself a smile. "Pleased to meet you. My name's Dr. Temperance Brennan." I knew who she was, of course, the heroine of her own genre, that of the forensic anthropologist.
"Very pleased to meet you," I said, rising to shake her hand. "Perhaps you'd care to join us?"
"Thank you, I shall." "This is Emperor Jacques," I said, "and the one with the spines is Mrs. Tiggywinkle."
"Hello," said Jacques, sizing her up for matrimony as he shook her hand. "How would you like the power of life or death over a billion godless heathens?"
She paused for a moment and raised an eyebrow. "Montreal suits me just fine." She shook Mrs. Tiggywinkle's claw, and they exchanged a few pleasantries over the correct method to wash linens. I ordered her some coffee, and after I'd asked about her Outlander book sales, which were impressively large compared to mine, she admitted to me that this wasn't a social call. "I've got an understudy covering for me, so I'll come straight to the point," she said, looking with apparent professional interest at Jacques' high cheekbones. "Someone's trying to kill me."
"You and I have much in common, Dr. Brennan," I replied.
"When did this happen?"
"Call me Tempy. Have you read my latest adventure?"
"Grave Secrets, of course."
"Near the end, I'm captured after being slipped a Mickey Finn. I talk my way out of it, and the bad guy kills himself."
"So?"
32 readings ago, I was drugged for real and nearly didn't make it. It was all I could do to stay conscious long enough to keep the book on its tracks. I'm first-person narrative, so everything's up to me."
"Yeah," I murmured. "That first-person thing can be a drag. Did you report it to Text Grand Central?"
She pushed the hair away from her face and said, "Naturally. But since I kept the show going, it was never logged as a textual anomaly. So according to the TGC, there's no crime. You know what they told me? Come back when you're dead, and then we can do something."
"Hmm," I said, drumming my fingers on the desk. "Who do you think is behind it?"
She shrugged. "No one in the book. We're all on very good terms."
"Any skeletons in the closet, if you'll excuse the expression?"
"Plenty. In crime, there's always at least one seriously bad guy to deal with per book, sometimes more."
"Narratively speaking, that's how it appears," I pointed out. "But with you dead, everyone else in your books would become redundant overnight, and with the possibility of erasure looming over them, your former enemies actually have some of the best reasons to keep you alive."
"Hmm," said Dr. Brennan thoughtfully. "I hadn't thought of it that way."
"The most likely person to want to kill you is someone outside your book. Any thoughts?"
"I don't know anyone outside my books. Except Kathy and Kerry, of course."
"It won't be them. Leave it with me," I said, after a moment's pause, "and I'll see what I can do. Just keep your eyes and ears open, yes?"
Dr. Brennan smiled and thanked me, shook my hand again, said goodbye to Jacques and Mrs. Tiggywinkle, and was gone, muttering that she had to relieve the substandard and decidedly bone-idle understudy who was standing in for her.
"What was that all about?" asked Jacques.
"No idea," I replied.
"It's kind of flattering that people bring their problems to me. I just wish there were another Thursday to deal with it."
"I thought there was.
Don't even joke about it, Emperor."
There was a crackle in the air, and Commander Bradshaw suddenly appeared just next to us. Jacques and Tiggywinkle looked guilty all of a sudden, and the hedge pig washerwoman made a vain attempt to hide the ironing she was doing.
"I thought I'd find you here," he said, moustache all a-twitch, as it was when he was a bit peeved. "That wouldn't be moonlighting, would it, Agent Tiggywinkle?"
"Not at all," she replied. "I spend so much time at jurisfiction, I can hardly get through the ironing I need for my own book."
"Very well," said Bradshaw, slowly turning to me. "I thought I'd find you here. I have a job that only you can handle.
I thought I was suspended. He passed me my badge.
The suspension was purely for the CFG's benefit. The disciplinary paperwork was accidentally eaten by snails. Most perplexing.
I smiled. What's up?
A matter of great delicacy. There are a few minor textual irregularities in the Thursday books.
Which ones? I asked, suddenly worried that Thursday 5 might have taken her failure to heart.
The first four. Since you know them quite well, and no one else wants to touch them, or her, with a barge pole, I thought you might want to check it out.
What sort of irregularities?
Small ones, said Bradshaw, handing me a sheet of paper. Nothing you'd notice from the Outland, unless you were a committed fan. I'm thinking it might be the early stage of a breakdown.
He didn't mean a breakdown in the Outlander sense. In the book world, a breakdown meant an internal collapse of the character's pattern of reason, the rules that made one predictable and understandable. Some, like Lucy Dean, collapsed spontaneously with an annoying regularity. Others just crumbled slowly from within, usually as a result of irreconcilable conflicts within their character. In either case, replacement by a fully trained-up generic was the only option. Of course, it might be nothing, and very possible that Thursday 1 through 4 was just angry about being fired and venting her spleen on the co-characters in the series. I'll check her out.
Good, said Bradshaw, turning to Jacques and Tiggywinkle. And you two? I want you all geared up and ready to try to get into the Speckled Band by way of the Disintegrator Ray by 1400 hours.
Bradshaw looked at his clipboard and then vanished. We all stood up.
Do you want us to come with you? Asked Jacques. Strictly speaking, your checking up on Thursday 1 through 4 is a conflict of interest transgression.
I'll be fine, I said. And the pair of them wished me well and vanished, like Bradshaw, into thin air.